CITR 101.9 on the FM dial. This is the Ink Stud Show, where we talk about comics and talk to comics people. I am joined by my good friend,
Don King. Don King.
Oh, I got the wrong mic turned on. There we go.
Don King.
There we go.
There
Hello,
we
Don.
Go.
And our special guest this week is Tim Sale. He is the artist of... Let's see, I got a stack in comics in front of me. Superman Confidential, currently running. A whole slew of stuff with Jeff Loeb. Batman Dark Victory, Long Halloween, Haunted Night... And some people may watch a TV show called Heroes, and he's the guy that does all the cool drawings for that, all the comic stuff. So we got you there, Tim?
You got me.
Was that a good intro?
It was excellent. Best ever.
Best
awesome.
Intro ever. So,
And also, let me thank you for queuing up Springsteen at the beginning of the show.
Was it a good song choice?
It was an excellent choice.
Excellent. That was Don's decision for the song. I just downloaded
thank you,
Don.
Yeah, anytime.
I downloaded Born to Run, and he picked the song. So we have Born to Run here, and we also have the Beatles' Help album for other
okay.
music. So in case we need song breaks, that's how it's going to go. So I guess we'll get started with your work. I like Heroes. Don's never watched Heroes. We're not going to go too much into Heroes stuff.
Okay.
We're more interested in you as an artist and kind of your work and your opinions and kind of your learning process and stuff.
Okay.
So we'll start out with, I guess, your latest project, which is the Superman Confidential that you're doing with Darwin Cook.
Mm-hmm.
Let's see, what's a good question to start with that? I guess, how is it working with Darwin Cook as a writer who is normally... writes for himself in comparisons
right.
with other stuff where the majority of works with Jeff Loeb, but I guess the closest would be maybe Matt Wagner, who illustrates his own stuff, but
right,
for
right.
the most part it's...
Right. Well, it is a very different in general to work with a writer who also is an artist. There can be a bit of a struggle there just because they see things better, and it's a little harder for them sometimes to be open to other ways of doing things and to write for other towards other artists' strengths and away from maybe their weaknesses if they are not exactly their own, if that makes any sense. And that I Superman Confidential is the first time Darwin has ever written for somebody other than himself.
Oh, really? I guess that
talked a little
makes
bit
sense.
About that before getting together. I asked to get together with Darwin, and then this came up. We share a friendship with Mark Chiarello, who's an editor and VP at DC,
and a fine artist in himself.
Great
as well.
Painter.
Very fine artist,
yeah.
And a very fine human being. Mm-hmm. And Mark has worked separately with both Darwin and myself for years, and. So just in the course of things, just as a fan, when I picked up New Frontier, I actually wrote the first fan letter I've ever written.
Oh, really?
To Darwin, and it were a fan email at times maybe.
Mm-hmm.
I sent it to Darwin, Dave Stewart, and Chiarella. And initially, I said, "I hate you because this is exactly the kind of thing." The look of the book is exactly the kind of thing that I'd like to do. Not necessarily the story, because I am not steeped in the DCU that Darwin is. But, you know, big images, really fun, punchy storytelling, really colorful. I'd never seen a book colored like that before.
Yeah,
both
it's
the technique and the colors chosen. And it just blew me away. And I... Because I don't follow comics that much, and I don't follow the comics press, it was a complete surprise to me. And I remember I called Jeff and said, "Do you know this book?" And he said, "Yeah, I work in the industry." And I said, "Well, okay. Well, I guess I don't work in the industry then." Because I was a huge fan of it. Am a huge fan of it, and a huge fan of Darwin's work. But our joy in our struggle on Confidential has been to find a way for him to enjoy writing the kind of story that he enjoys writing, and for me to find my way into drawing a little bit differently than I have drawn before in order to fit the story in a comedy. Yeah. That's right.
I guess it's like in, not necessarily playing to each other's strengths, but playing to each other's passions in a way.
And the struggle is to try to find that and to have the same ones. Now, you don't have to be a writer-artist to have that same thing. And mm-hmm. it seems to me that the industry in the last 5-10 years has increasingly been dominated by the power that writers have.
Uh-huh.
And the
Definitely.
Kind of cult of personality around writers that didn't really exist before.
That's a great term. I was actually thinking of in reference to Warren Ellis and his cult of minions online. So,
it's funny. I work in a comic store, and uh-huh. and people come in, and they even guys like Joss Whedon or whatever, the guy that sure. did the Buffy stuff. It's like people are looking for stuff by certain writers, and I look at a lot. I mean, personally, I look at a lot of it and go, "Well, this is like third rate Mickey Spillane junk." But whatever, you know.
You mean the writing or the
yeah the art? Writing, like the art. Usually, I mean, to me, the art's awesome most of the time, but the sometimes I find the writing is I just don't get it.
See, I have a little bit of a different take on it. I think that most of the time, those books sell, and I don't know how this happened, but those books sell based on the writing, and the art can be mediocre to bad.
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's
and it doesn't really affect either the buzz.
Or the sales.
Fan interest, or necessarily the sales. Yeah. I mean, obviously, when you've got Frank Miller and Jim Lee on a book, no matter what it is, it's going to sell a whole bunch of issues, right? Mm-hmm. You know, but that's a different kind of animal. That's a very different thing. The bulk of the industry is now built around kind of star writers, and they can work with anybody and sell books. And that's a really different thing, it seems to me.
It actually kind of surprises me because basically my take on it was always in the 70s that it was an editor-run, industry. Like
DC especially.
Yeah, especially. But it was basically the editors kind of decided everything, and they would kind of allow talent in. Like, they wouldn't pick people to bring in. They would, like, allow whoever got along with them or whatever, for whatever reason.
Right.
It seems today that there is, like, a complete change in that.
You know? Well, that's been a longer process, but it seems to me that the first chink in that armor was Image, mm-hmm. and actually right before that, all of these guys selling millions of comics for Marvel, mm-hmm. and the art and the artist was the star, and the characters were secondary, and after they all left to form Image, the editors at Marvel said, you know, we gotta take this back. Mm-hmm. And they did, it seems to me. And that was the kind of imprinting of the X group and the way the X group just dominated the field for 5 years or something.
Yeah, it's actually
you could bring any writer and any artist in, and they were all disposable. Because the X-Men were the star, right?
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
And that was a real reaction against how much the company had been hurt by allowing the artists to be such stars before. And so both those two sides of things, that everything is out of whack, right? When you just let the artists do anything they want to do, the writing gets crazy and the characters go bad.
Or just plain crappy.
When you say we don't need good art, we can sell millions of copies with bad stuff and bad writing. And that's out of whack too. And you're trying to find a balance for all that.
Now
it seems to me that you can, with good writing, it's kind of the flip of the Image guys writing. With good writing, you can sell anything.
Thankfully.
Yeah. You know what's funny though, is like that you mentioned the writers kind of dominate the industry now, and I always thought in the late 70s and all that, when I was really into comic books, I always thought that like where the comics usually lacked was the story, and then and now it's funny because now they don't have that excuse and some of them are still crappy, you know. It's like,
well, that's the kind of next step of it. It seems to me that the when I was talking about writer-artists having a struggle to think of working a way of working with another artist because they see their own pictures in their own head. Most of the star writers now just write scripts, and they don't, as far as I know, they could work with anybody.
Mm-hmm.
There isn't a sense of who are you working with.
There's no collaboration.
It's a collaboration, yeah. Right? What does that person want to do? What does that person do well?
Mm-hmm.
Not do well? How can I craft a story that's fun for me and fun for them and make it big? And I was tremendously spoiled by 15 years of Jeff Loeb. And mm-hmm. and we didn't begin that way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, Jeff did not have he had a comic fan background, but not a comic writing background when we first started working together. And we went through four or five different ways of working before we really hit on something that was comfortable for both of us. And also in that time, we became very good friends, and so it
became easier.
It morphed into a kind of great. He knew what I wanted to do. He loved. He could write a lot of different things. You know, he's interested in a lot of different things, and he loved writing towards my desires as well. And I happen to think that the work we do together is the best work that each of us does, mm-hmm. even though we work with other people as well. But there aren't very many people that go that collaborate.
Yeah,
it seems to me. I'm not exactly sure why, but
and that's
something that I've had conversations with other writers. Once I knew that I was going to be not working with Jeff exclusively so much, I had conversations with a number of writers, and the things that I talk to them about, often they look at me like I'm crazy.
Well, that's something I just noticed through your work. It seems very specific on who you work with as far as writers goes, because looking like, I mean, you get primarily Jeff Loeb as your partner in crime, I guess.
Mm-hmm.
Plus, it seems your choice is very specific. I mean, you're doing it with Darwin Cook, who...
And
artistically, I'd say you guys have very different styles, but kind of similar influences.
Yes.
And I also noticed that you handpick colorists, too, to work with you, like Teddy Christensen and people like that. And
Teddy Christensen.
Yeah.
Teddy's a great guy and a great colorist. Yeah, no, absolutely. I have a strong personality. I have strong opinions.
I like that, actually.
I'm also very aware of my own limitations.
You know what? It's funny you said that when you have very strong opinions about things. I just recently read that Black and White book, the interview book,
yep.
and I found it so refreshing to read an interview with somebody, because I really knew nothing about your background, and I just found it refreshing to read about somebody that had common sense opinions about things, and it sounded like you didn't come through the comic book world with all the sort of the preconceived notions of what people say. You know, I totally like that.
Well, thank you. There was a balancing act going on there, and I would have conversations with Richard Starkings, who was mm-hmm. the publisher and the interviewer mm-hmm. in that book.
Who does? He does Elephant Men, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
Richard's background is he's English, and he was one of the first guys that he actually hand lettered The Killing Joke.
Hmm. Oh wow!
That was the last thing he hand lettered.
Hmm.
He foresaw the future, and computer lettering was what was going to change things, and he was the first company based on computer lettering.
Hmm.
And he figured out how to make that work so that it didn't look like, you know, typing or something.
Yeah.
And but he's a very smart, very ambitious, very creative man, and so beyond lettering, he and his company also do designs, and he writes Elephant Men, and he writes for Ladrone on Kid Flask, publishes various other things. So it anyway, he's a great guy, a great collaborator, and Loeb feels the same way about him. And Loeb actually has Richard letters all my books in his contract.
Oh,
and he's the only guy the writer I know that sort of feels that way about.
Wow,
about a letter or anything.
Actually, well, Walter Simonson does the same thing. I think he works with, I think it's John Workman.
Yeah, he said. I didn't know if he had that in his contract.
I don't know if it was in his contract, but he actually he said that he handpicked him to do his lettering because he said, to tell you the truth, I think it looks good with my artwork. That's why I picked him. And and it's like it is neat that you seem to be coming from the same.
Collaborative process.
Yeah. Like right. where like you're not only are you picking people that you enjoy working with, but you're picking people that are going to enhance what you're doing with their talents.
And that brings us back to what you were saying initially, right? I can't color. I can't write, or I haven't figured out how to do it yet. I haven't.
You're colorblind, aren't you?
I am colorblind.
Is it like red-green colorblind? Or?
It's not easy to describe.
Yeah.
It's not that simple.
Yeah, no, yeah. I'm colorblind, too, so I was wondering.
Oh, okay. Well, there are a lot of... I'm told there are like 20 different versions of being colorblind.
Oh, okay.
And I know that strangely enough, about 5 or 6 years ago, I was at a festival in... a comics festival in Barcelona. And when... I was interviewed a number of times by various media in a little room they take you off to. And one of the guys was also a ophthalmologist, optometrist, something, whatever. And he said, I've read these interviews with you before in preparation for this interview I'm about to do, and I know exactly the kind of colorblind you are. And he told me what it was, and I forgot it, but... I have a specific type. Essentially, what it means is that I can see color, but I can't kind of create with color.
Yeah, that's exactly where I'm at. But I find that probably that didn't seem to inhibit you, because you seem to concentrate more on, like maybe as a default, you concentrate on design, and being bold with black and white, and it works. You know,
comics are interesting in that way. Actually, there are a lot of famous and very accomplished comic artists who are colorblind.
John Byrne, I know, is one, and Howard Chaykin, I believe.
And Alex Toth, who's one of my gods.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, we ought to send you a package of stuff. We just recently acquired some character model sheets that he did.
Please do.
Yeah. Some photocopies. These are pretty neat. It's all the some Super Friends stuff and some Fantastic Four stuff.
Yeah.
And that's kind of, I guess, Toth was a kind of a big influence for, that's what I was kind of going at with Darwin Cook, is you both have that very, that Toth influence.
But you both, simpler.
But you take it in like completely different directions.
Yep. Mm-hmm. True. You can see the similarity. You can see the influence, I think. But yeah, you can go a lot of different ways from that. It's easier to see Darwin's similarity to somebody like Bruce Timm.
Yeah, he worked with him, I believe.
And Bruce is also a huge Toth guy.
He's awesome.
And I remember I was at one of the early on in my friendship with Chiarello. I was at a dinner with him, and we were kind of going around going, "Okay, who's your favorite? Top three favorite?" And Chiarello said, Toth.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And you can't really see it necessarily in his work.
No, but it's...
Right? No, he's the be-all and end-all for Mark.
That's interesting. A lot of people really see him as a big influence, but his stuff just isn't.
It's like the artist.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, he's the biggest artist.
Yeah. Yeah, I agree. Actually, I was going to ask about, like, speaking of influences, one thing I really noticed in your work is it's almost like non-comic book-like in that you have, it shows that you were influenced by things outside of comic books, which is always refreshing. You know, like a lot of fine art. In your interview book, you mentioned some of the different, like, illustrators and painters and things like that.
Right.
And like specifically you talked about how you used Norman Rockwell as an influence on the Superman book.
Yep.
And I was wondering if there was, were there other artists that you used as influences specifically for different stories that you've done? Or?
Sure. It is actually less fine art than other commercial art, but just outside of comics.
Uh-huh.
It is easier and easier now, both through the internet and more books are being published about this kind of thing. But the amount of great stuff, great artists producing great stuff in illustration, primarily in America, but Canada also, from the 30s through the 60s and 70s, but mostly the 40s and 50s, really. It was just staggering. And it was before photographs kind of took over magazines.
Yeah, that is like the heyday of, especially North American illustration, when you get by guys like Bob Peake, and I've actually, you're one of the few artists that I've ever heard of that mentioned by name René Gruau, who I thought
I was going to mention him.
He's
you pronounce his name much better than I do.
Oh, okay. Yeah, he's awesome.
He is awesome. Mm-hmm. And when I first saw his work, I was immediately drawn to it, and actually, kind of somewhat strangely, a Toth kind of way, in that he's so interested in design and a kind of flair with it, that the combination of simple and kind of an expression of joy. And audacity.
Yeah, I think.
And then they would crop half a face and just have okay, we'll just do it from the legs up, or something like that. When it's just a different way of looking and thinking at things, and you're telling the story, you're getting what you need to get across.
Yeah, I think it was Roy Crane or somebody that said one time about drawing comics, that he would try to. Come up with the most powerful, simple image, and then draw the hell out of it. Mm-hmm. Like you said, but you want to keep it graphic. You want it to be as simple and as stark as it can be, so people will grab it instantly. But
Well, you're dropping names when you talk about Roy Crane. But,
yeah. Yeah. Sorry, I didn't mean to.
Thank you for doing so. That's true. The similarity that I was drawing between Toth and Gruau was. Not just the simplicity, but the boldness of design, and saying I'm just gonna only show half the image, and that is really cool. You have to know what half of the image to show, and how much it's going to take to get the point across. And
yeah, it's almost like all the 90% of the thinking with people like that is up front, and what they put down is after they've thought about it for a hell of a long time. Yep. Then it looks like they did something easy.
Right. No, absolutely. And that is sort of a definition of great art, and that you do a lot of the thinking beforehand. But then it isn't as though that the technique is then secondary.
No.
You haven't planned it all out, as it were. You have to have a flair in the execution as well, and I just love that stuff. So, look, I know that I'm older than most. I generally figured that when I walk into a room of other comic guys, I'm, unless there's golden age people there, I'm the oldest guy around. Uh-huh. And that says something about me, but it also says something about the industry, right? And I turn 51 next week.
Oh, really?
And
when I got to meet you briefly in Seattle, I actually thought you were probably late 30s, early 40s, maybe.
Well, thank you very much. I'll pass that on to my parents. they gave me these jeans.
Yeah.
But nonetheless, that and I didn't start drawing comics professionally until I was about 30. So that absolutely, even though I was a fan younger, and tried to get into the industry. Younger, it didn't actually happen for me until I went away for a while and came back and whatever life experience, it wasn't like I went to Tibet and studied Buddhism or anything. whatever life experience I'd absorbed broadened my interests, and I know that I I'm both not interested, and I think I would be terrible at trying to draw really quote unquote commercially. And what's commercial does change, but for a long time now, people like Jim Lee and Mike Turner and that sort of thing, those guys sell anywhere from 5 to 100 times what I sell. And more power to them. It isn't, I get to make a living. I can't do that anyways. I'm glad some people like what I do.
There's a lot of us.
There is a kind of inbredness to the way they work, which is part of their power. I mean,
they're creating a community.
Yeah, absolutely. And they are consistently fulfilling the desires of that community. And I'm more confusing, or I'm just weirder looking. it is. It's a more kind of expressionistic way of working.
I was going to mention that your work does, it does have like a very, when I read that you do most of, you're most comfortable doing a lot of work in ink, directly into ink, and it shows in a good way. Like, it's like your drawings have life to them. They don't look like that you erased the same image and did little bubble men underneath everything for 3 hours and then, noodled around with it. It has life to it. I really enjoy that.
Well, I appreciate that, and the truth of the matter is I do a lot of the little bubble men. I used to do less of it, and I learned that my eye would fool my brain, or my brain would fool my eye, whichever way it works, and I would think something looked good, and it really didn't. It wasn't until it was in print that I recognized that fact. And that you can have such joy in drawing with the brush and drawing with a lot of black that you can just fool yourself as to how good something looks. And the underdrawing of it all wasn't as strong as it could have and should have been. And I think as I've grown, hopefully as an artist, I've gotten better at that and maintaining the spontaneous look and the fun of it all, kind of, but also with a solider structure underneath.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
I have a friend that would sometimes look at his work in the mirror just to kind of separate himself from it.
It's a great legitimate technique. Either a mirror or you hold it up to the light. See the reverse of it.
Yeah, or you put it against the wall overnight, and then in the morning you shock yourself with how bad it is.
Absolutely.
That's what I do.
I'm just going to remind people, we're speaking with Tim Sale, artist extraordinary, collaborated with Jeff Loeb on numerous projects, including Batman Long Halloween, Dark Victory, Haunted Night, Daredevil Yellow, Spider-Man Blue, Hulk Gray, and also for those of you that watch lots of TV or don't watch a lot of TV and just watch one show, is the guy that does all the art for Heroes. And it is 1:30 the hour, so I said if people want to call in and ask Tim some questions, the phone number is 604-822-2487, and I will just be bringing you right on air, because I am the operator as well as the host. Make sure you're ready.
I will say that I announced that I was going to be doing this thing on my website.
Oh, awesome.
Last night, and there were a few people that said they might be calling in.
So. Oh, well, we have our first one right now, so you're on the air.
Hey, am I on?
You're on the air.
Yep.
You're on, and I'm here.
Yeah.
Very cool. Hi, it's Kelly.
Hey, Kelly.
How's it going?
Kel, you're kind of warbly. I wonder what's going on with that.
I don't know. You're warbly too.
Yeah, we got warble factor.
Yeah,
through
we have a little bit of an echo in the line here.
I don't know if it's like some kind of Canadian phone cord that's made out of trees or something.
Yeah, you know, Kelly's from Calgary, so you never know what's going on.
Oh, they got the oil phone cords there.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, I don't know. I'm just operating on phase over here. I got my cell phone stuff.
So, okay. you got a question for us, Kelly?
Huh? Oh gosh. What don't I know? Well, I guess I know you've got the exclusive with DC, and you haven't really seemed to have made up your mind what's next. But what's next?
Well, first of all, let me just say to the listeners, I've known Kelly for a long time. We have yet to meet, but Kelly's a longstanding fan. I was actually kind of introduced to him via Jeff, because Jeff was online long before I was, and Kelly was one of a cadre of people who would, under various pseudonyms, write in to DC and write in to Jeff about speculating on the storyline and the plot lines and who the villain was on both Dark Victory and on Long Halloween. So I eventually created my own friendship with Kelly a little bit later. And Kelly's an aspiring artist and a clown boy and all kinds of things. Well, Kelly, I, as I'm sure you know, I can only partly say certain things. I am still exclusive with DC for about another 100 pages worth of work after Superman Confidential is done. There is indeed a specific story that I have talked with another writer and with Mark Cerullo about doing afterwards. It will be a DC licensed property. It is not an old DCU character, but it's somebody that I wanted to do for a long time, and it may or may not actually happen, but this is what we've been talking about. So that is, I guess, about as good as I can answer that question.
Really enigmatic.
And as for after that, it's really up in the air.
Well, best of luck. When are we going to see the creator-owned book?
Yeah,
it's weird. I can hear myself.
You really were asking about. that could be what happens next. Every time I run into Jeff, he says, "When are you coming over to Marvel?"
Icon?
Yeah, I guess it's not. It's all speculation, you know. So I will say that I had a. Joe Quesada for years has kind of been after me. He loved the like 4 pages of the FF that I did in Daredevil Yellow, and he said, "You got to come do the FF." And the FF is Jeff's number one favorite comic ever. And I've always said I hate group books. I don't want to do that. I'm partly lazy, but I also partly just don't want to. They don't interest me that much. And Joe cornered me at a San Diego convention a few years ago and started talking to me about just doing a kind of ostensibly an FF book, but really it's a story about the Thing, and it's about Ben Grimm. And it Ben is the kind of is another one of those kind of quintessential Loeb sale tragic figures.
Hulk, great, right?
And when he sold it to me, it made sense kind of for the first time ever, so I suppose that's out there too. I don't. But I don't know. There are creative-owned stuff that I'd like to do. And it could be that. I may have reached that point.
Well, it's all good. Anyway, I'll let you go. You have a good day, okay?
All right, Kelly.
Thanks, Kelly.
Bye.
Thanks for calling, man.
Thanks a lot.
Goddamn Canadian phone lines. the warble happens to us sometimes, sometimes less, sometimes more so. That is something interesting. It is your early work isn't so much superhero. I mean, Grendel is a kind of a beast in its own. But was superhero something you really wanted to get into? Or Don was telling me earlier, fantasy seemed to be more something you were really into.
Early on, yeah, it was. it kind of, well, as a kid, I was very much superheroes. I also then, at about, I don't know, 15, became enamored of Conan and Lord of the Rings and got into that. But I still was I was a total Marvel guy. I wasn't, I didn't do any DCU stuff. But I love superheroes as well. But as I kind of matured in the field, and by matured I mean got older, I don't know how much maturity there was happening. You know, through the 80s there was the black and white boom, and there was a lot of different ways of looking at comics and looking at superheroes. And so towards the, you know, late 80s there were things like Watchmen and you know, the rise of Frank Miller and what he was doing. And
Before the Fall.
Oh!
Yeah, well, there's that too.
Yeah.
But there's no denying what he contributed that was great.
Oh, yeah. He did some of my favorite.
I'm not denying the fall, but I'm just saying, when you fall by your work making billions of dollars for movie companies, you know, it's a relative term.
Yeah, exactly.
There's creative and there's commercial falling.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that forever, but. Yeah. It was an exciting time to think about things differently. And really, when I hooked up with Jeff had no interest at all in doing anything other than superheroes.
Really?
Yeah, no, that's what he likes about comics. He didn't want to tell some, you know, ecologically correct story. I did something for Kimiko.
That was
Amazon.
With Steve Siegel, one of my favorite writers.
One of your what?
One of my favorite writers. I'm a big fan of his stuff.
Steve lives about a mile away from me.
Oh?
Here in SoCal. And I think that was his second comics work, and it was certainly early on in my career. We have, by the way, retained all of the original artwork.
Oh, wow.
It has been recolored, and I am doing new covers for it. It is now... it's going to be published by Dark Horse Comics later this year.
Hmm.
And they're going to do 3 individual issues and then a trade. So
that's awesome.
Look for that. It's on the Amazon.
That's excellent. And it's that was one of your earliest stories, too.
It absolutely was, yes.
At the time, had you seen anything by Hugo Pratt? Because I found it reminded me a lot of, like, the Corto Maltese and the jungle sort of scenes and things.
You know, you're continuing to drop names.
No, he's
Dog,
one of, he's
Dog,
one
there's
of my,
something on the floor.
Yeah,
it's
he's one of, no, he's one of my favorites, and I just I was just wondering if you had seen his stuff at that time.
You know, I don't remember if I had. I very much have now. I may have, but there's a... I'll get a little more name-dropping and more obscure. There's another Spanish artist. No, Pratt's Italian, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. There's a Spanish artist
you could say shit. It's college radio.
Yeah, sorry.
Listener discretion be advised.
There
you go.
Pellejero. Pellejero.
Okay.
You've got Don stumped. Very good.
No, I don't. I don't know. I just want to hear about him.
Okay. Yeah. Well, he had he's had work, and I saw his work reprinted in Heavy Metal, and this would have been late '80s, and it's both black and white and color, and it holds up in black and white and in color. And he had a continuing character. He worked with a writer whose last name was Zentner, Z-E-N-T-N-E-R. Also Spanish, and it starred a guy named Dieter Lumpen.
Mm-hmm.
So why they picked this kind of German name, I don't know. But and he was just a kind of adventurer, and they could plop him down anywhere in the world and tell a story about things that happened to him. And some of the stories took place in tropical climates. And I just loved his work. And I still do. And that was what I wanted to do, more than Pratt. But, you know, look, we're all kind of... Pratt is another son of Toth, right?
Yeah, and Milton Caniff and all them.
the idea, as is Miller, right? As is Sin City, as is, you know, as is Mignola, and, you know, all these kind of artists, right? Miller being the most commercial of the bunch, but all these guys that love the contrast of heavy blacks and skinny lines. And
I almost think for the Miller stuff, Musicelli would be the more important reference point there.
For me, or
for just for, so. For really like for the kind of the example you're kind of using, it seems more like it's the Musicelli part to it than necessarily the Miller part to the year one.
I don't know that more. I mean, Miller's work in Dark Knight less so, but certainly his Sin City work is heavy, high contrast stuff. Look, I'm an enormous fan. I think Miller's best work and Mazzucchelli's best work is
Year One.
Is Year One?
Yeah, I agree.
I think it's the best Batman thing that's ever been done.
I actually told somebody the other day that I thought that Batman Year One may be the best superhero kind of graphic novel I've ever read.
Mm-hmm.
I think it holds up really well.
I do too, and I think Richmond Lewis did a hell of a job. Mm-hmm. I think it was Todd Klein's best work. I thought it was great all the way around.
Mm-hmm.
Audacious and a way of taking the old, tired, hard-bitten Private Eye kind of way of writing and just doing the hell out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
In a way that has kind of been codified and drained of all life in Sin City, in my view.
Yeah, I agree.
But the other day I just went. It's one of those kind of things where, I have a category book, and I like to. Chirillo and I like to play a game. We go top five. Okay, top five songs with the best rock and roll scream. Okay, top five, you know. And one of my things is top five movies that when you run across them on TV, you have to stop and watch.
Uh-huh.
Well, Year One is one of those things where I just pick it up and go, I need a reference for what the Roman looked like when he was first made. And I just end up reading the whole damn book.
Yeah. It's true. It's just...
For yourself doing the Batman stuff, the Haunted Knight and the Dark Victory, was that kind of something you enjoyed to be able to elaborate further on that story?
I didn't feel the history of it that much. I know that there was concern from Jeff, primarily, that he expressed to DC, are they going to allow us to do it? And is Frank going to have a problem? Does Frank envision coming back and telling more stories? And he doesn't want to have us messing with it. And Frank signed off, to his credit. Thank you, Frank. But I don't feel the history of it that much. I really enjoyed it. But that was really more because I really enjoyed working with Jeff and the stories he wrote. I hated it in Batman Begins, actually.
I didn't.
Ridiculous.
Yeah. Oh, don't get me.
Just too much stuff in it.
I don't understand. That seems to be the trend these days. When they make a bloody movie about a comic book, it's like they don't just pick a Batman and tell a good story. It's like they have to get every goddamn villain in one movie, or like Spider-Man, it'll have like six villains, and you basically see them all for about a minute and a half, and no one cares. You know?
Well, you know why.
Well,
I know why.
Yeah,
and
sells toys.
sell toys, and if the studio's going to pay $150 million for you to make your movie, they want a lot of stuff.
Yeah, it better not be good.
Look, it's really frustrating, absolutely.
Yeah.
And I have no knowledge. Well, let me back up a little bit. I know that Christopher Nolan has expressed admiration for Long Halloween, and sort of David Goyer, and that what Jeff essentially did, and I did through visuals, but I think their take is more what Jeff did with the milieu of how to tell a Batman story and what they could do in a movie. It was really helpful for them.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's terrific. And I'm a fan of both of those gentlemen's work outside of Batman Begins.
Mm-hmm.
And but I look at Batman Begins and I go, all I can think of is, okay, Nolan made the movie he wanted to make for the first 40 minutes, and then he had to make the studio's movie.
Yep. Yeah. Oh, yeah, totally.
Yeah, yeah.
I have it's no like knowledge. It's just my take as a fan
it looks like watching
the movie.
Yeah, it looks like two different movies where one is a ninja movie, and then the second half is another shitty Batman movie. You know, like based
the
on the
city's
movie.
Falling apart.
No,
yeah.
We can't say shit. I thought we couldn't say shit.
No, you can.
Yeah, this is college radio.
We can. Oh, right.
Well, it's Canada.
Yeah.
I gave the listener discretion be advised. Kids.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
We got another question. So,
okay, good.
Why don't I toss whoever it is on air? Okay, you're on air.
Oh, hey, Tim. How are you?
I'm fine. Who am I talking to?
It's Brian Mulcahy.
Hey, Brian.
From the East Coast Red Sox fan contingent.
There you go. The lawyer man steps up. You were listening. We had the clown boy up earlier, and now we have the lawyer man.
Oh, clown boy. Yeah, I wasn't able to listen. I was on the train coming home.
Okay, well, you have a warbly line just like clown boy.
Yeah, I think when we have two people on air, it kind of gets a little...
It happens to happen.
It thins out. So we'll keep the... Just have you on for the question.
Okay. Tim, I was actually just looking at your Christine story in Solo again. I was wondering, is the male lead in that based on anyone in particular?
It's me.
Oh, I thought so. That looks a little like you.
Well, visually, it's me. I don't end up dead. It actually, the truth behind that story, Brian, is other than... Let's see, the first and second and last page. I drew that story for my girlfriend, Christina, as a kind of love note of us walking on the beach for her birthday one year.
Oh.
And when I was putting together Solo, I had a conversation with Chiarello about, you know, I'd love to use this, but what can I do? I don't want to do it just verbatim. And he suggested making this noir out of it, and flipping the ending, to not be a sweet ending, being a bittersweet ending, and he helped an awful lot with the writing on it, and so that's the genesis of that story. But the core of it, at least image-wise, all the stuff walking on the beach and looking at each other's eyes and the kiss, that's all there in her birthday card.
Thanks,
guys. I gotta get going.
Thanks for coming on.
Thanks.
Cheers.
Yeah, I was going to say that book is a great example of one thing I noticed flipping through a lot of your stuff is you really do a great job of graphically like placing blacks on a page and things. Everything balances really well. There's nothing strange when you look at the page, you know.
Well, thank you. It's important to me, and I both work at it and don't work at it. You know, it's one of those. It is
second nature now.
Yeah, what kind of? But always kind of was. I mean, any artist will have some things that come easier to him than other things, right? And that is one of the things that came easy to me. But there are plenty of things that I struggle over constantly.
Well, that's always the sign. I actually have a theory that the more easy it comes for somebody to do something, the less the payoff might be. Because it seems if it's still a struggle, you know, people just don't take it for granted that people are going to want to see something. Like you have to, I think it was you in the interview that talked about you're making comics for people that don't read comic books.
Right.
It's like it's easy to make comics for people that read comic books because they buy anything with goddamn Batman in it.
Right.
But getting somebody to sit down and read a comic and enjoy it that isn't based, they don't have like a foundation in that. That's it seems to be a struggle.
Well, it's not struggle. It's been impossible for the industry how to figure out how to do it, and it's an industry that's based on and run by sort of geeks who grew up in the industry.
Yeah, it's a little bit inbred.
And they haven't. And there are all kinds of things that go along with it. There isn't any one finger pointed at anything, but the positive things that happened with the direct market, and the positive things that happened with the rise of comic book stores, are also what has killed the periodical nature of comics.
I was saying that the other day. I think it was in the 70s that 80% of comics are sold over the newsstand, and now 85% of comics are sold through comic stores, which is fine, except no one's just casually picking them up and looking at them anymore.
Well, and you're also
how
at
old
the,
are the people that go into a comic?
Yeah, 35.
And you're also at the the whims of the ways of the comic store owner who, in some situations, you may miss something because they decide not to order it or it doesn't.
Well, it's basically the fans control the industry now. It's like the lunatics are running the asylum.
Oh no!
Well, but it's not just that. It yes and no, because fans don't. When you only have a destination place to go to get what you want to get, first of all, you have to still want to go there every week, right?
Yeah.
And most people don't. It's harder to get there. It's not like you're just waiting at the bus stop and there's a newsstand there. That's one thing. Or for me, I grew up in Seattle, but it was a drugstore that was on the way home from school, right? I could stop in every day.
Me too.
Check stuff out. But that was easy to go. It wasn't a destination spot to go to. Now I didn't have any say, absolutely. As a kid, I didn't have any say as to what was being, other than buying something, what was being produced. But it isn't quite as simple as saying the lunatics are running the asylum, because if you don't see a bunch of stuff because the owners. And that's the direct market of it, right? The store owners don't want to take a chance on certain things, right? So they don't order them.
Yeah.
And then nobody ever gets to see his stuff.
Yeah, and half the time you're at the...
It really kills certainly the periodical nature of comics. I can't, for a long time, I've not been able to see that surviving.
Yeah, I actually noticed that it seems... it looks like basically they only put out the sort of pamphlet comics now.
I hate that term.
No, well, but basically.
I know why you would hate it, but yeah. I understand why somebody would use it.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, it's like I didn't know how else to put it, but because basically, it seems that the major companies, or every company now, it's almost like those are kind of like a byproduct of just making a little more cash before you release the book. It's like a promotion for the book that's eventually going to come out of the same thing.
Well, and then the flip of that is that, well, then we better throw as many fucking ads in there as we possibly can.
Yeah, exactly.
So it's unreadable.
Yeah. Oh, I can't stand. You flip through a comic book, and then suddenly there's like a Twinkie ad, but it's like it looks like a comic book.
It looks like a page.
Yeah, I couldn't even. It's distracting.
That's from the 80s, the Twinkie ads.
No, but at least the Twinkie ad didn't look like the rest of the goddamn comic
book.
Or
the fruitcakes.
Yeah.
We're right nearing the end, so I figure I should ask a hero's question because I'm sure there's a substantial. People watch that show, I hear.
Yeah, a few people.
So we have about, I guess, 3 minutes, so I'll ask a quick, kind of the process question, because, well, from what I understand, those paintings are basically just blow-ups.
Yeah.
Do you just kind of, do, a pencil and or an ink drawing, and then they color it, or?
Well, it's the same way that Catwoman Went to Rome and Daredevil Yellow, almost all my detective covers, things like that. It's the same process that I do it in black and white and gray, ink wash, charcoal, ink, that kind of thing. And then scan that. That file is then sent to a colorist. In the case of Heroes, it's Dave Stewart. At least one of the top two best colorists. In the
Oh, yeah, he's awesome.
They've been probably for me, Jose Villarubia.
Yeah,
he's fantastic.
He's great, and Chiarella would be my other. guy that I put up there.
Actually, I did notice that you are probably the only mainstream artist, if you can, I can call you that. No offense.
Which part? The artist or the...
Yeah, like you're one of the only artists that actually uses wash anymore. Like no one seems to really do that much.
I think Gene Ha does.
Yeah, well, Gene Ha does, but even in his finished stuff, I don't even know if it's wash.
Well, I don't know that it's so much. I mean, it's funny that you would say any more about it.
I'm just thinking about nobody
ever did very much of it. Well, but I was an enormous fan. If you read Tim Sale Black and White, you know that I was an enormous fan of the Warren books in the 60s and 70s.
Oh yeah,
where it was. Well, it was all black and white. It wasn't all wash, but it was all black and white. And a lot of people that were better known in their mainstream work liked Ditko, and one of like Toth, because he was never that well known. But Ditko, Colin, Neil Adams, they all did some of their absolute best work.
Oh yeah.
In the black and white and wash.
Yeah, I think my favorite Walt Simonson story is the one he did with Archie Goodwin about the spiders and the samurai one for that Atlas one. I thought that was just fantastic.
Well, Archie actually was, I was talking earlier about writers who are interested in collaborating with artists and figuring out what they want to do. Archie was tremendous that way, and I was fortunate enough to get to know Archie just a little bit before he died and work with him, and just a great creator, great collaborator, great guy.
One of the top editors ever in the field.
But and that's absolutely true. But there was the through line for all of it is what made him great as a writer too, and that he was interested in collaborating.
Yeah, he's actually one person that I've never heard a bad word about.
No, people don't have bad things.
Yeah,
to say about
exactly. Anyway,
I've got a unfortunately. I'm really enjoying this conversation, but I have a storm of angry hip-hoppers with arms full of records staring at me through a window who are supposed to come on about 2 minutes ago.
Okay. So,
thank you very much, Tim. That was awesome.
That's how the Heroes artwork is done. It's done in black and white, and Dave Stewart colored it, and they blow it up and print it on canvas. Wow.
So there you go. We asked the Heroes question for the listeners that were hoping for a Heroes question.
I think we're going to end. Are we going to end with Dizzy Miss Lizzy?
We're going to end with Dizzy Miss Lizzy by the Beatles.
Because you mentioned best rock and roll screams. I think this would have to be up there.
Absolutely. Thank you, guys.
Thank you so much. Have a good day, Tim.
Bye-bye.
Bye. And thank you very much to Tim Sale. And don't forget, next week it'll be Ed Pisker. Week after that will be Gary Groth and Kim Thompson. And the week after that, I don't know yet. We'll find out. Up next, Crimes and Treasons. What? We'll be right back.